suffering from our inability in this area of relationships. Many times it's not in our personal relationships so much as at work. We spend a lot of time at work, and we seem to spend a lot of time at work in conflict, or at least if not in outright conflict, somewhat unhappy about the people that are surrounding us. So tradition four is each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. In the relationship form, that's each individual should be autonomous except in matters affecting those in the relationship or others. And I'm not another, by the way. Here's a great example for me in this area. January of 05, my old cat that I'd had for 19 years, Rocky, died. And I coincidentally, next week I went out and spent a week with Don and Aurora. And this is kind of a detour, but we were up sitting in that meditation room of his. There, Jim would know that. And somebody had given him a big 8x10 blow-up of his old mugshot from the Denver police files. And it's on the wall, and we're sitting there and side by side in the chairs and talking with each other. And I said, "You know, Don," I said, "I can't believe that a guy like me that used to take human life with little thought or feeling at all can be all broken up over an old cat." And he looked at me and had tears in his eyes, and he pointed over that mugshot and he says, "Well, that's because we've been changed." He says, "I'm not that guy over there either anymore. I can't be that guy anymore." And so we get changed. But anyway, when I got back from Don's within about a week, I'm down at the Humane Society, and I found a cat. And I brought the cat home, and I lived by myself, me and the cat. And my lady Linda came over, and she came through the door, and the cat came up to greet her, and she says, "What is that thing?" The cat is now named Thing, by the way. Sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing. But I can't understand. She's just turned to a block. I have given her a hug, and she just turned to a block of ice. And what's going on here? And she said, "Well, you know, it took a while to get here, but you know, eventually," she says, "you know, the last cat you had lasted 19 years. And she said, "You know, if we're going to spend time together and grow in our relationship, I'm going to apparently spend time living with this thing. Don't you think you should have talked to me before you made that decision, a 19-year decision?" You know, and I didn't even see it. I saw it, well, I had a cat before, you know, so what's the big deal if I replace the cat with another cat? See, I didn't take into account how I needed. Now, she wasn't going to tell me I couldn't have a cat. She's a reasonable woman and a very kind and loving one. But what I did is, and I see how I do that, have done that all through my life, I just unthinkingly take what, you know, if I'd let it be, I could have created an opportunity. First of all, it's going to be harder for her to get to like that cat, because she had no part in that decision. And second of all, I just, every time I do that and disregard somebody else in the relationship, I do that in the office all the time, or I've done it all the time. I make some small decision, you know, I'll decide on what kind of a copier we're going to have, for example, and we won't consult the secretary that's going to use it more than anybody else. You know, how bright is that? So what I do is I have an opportunity to build a better relationship with somebody. Doesn't cost me a thing, and I've passed it up because I'm blind to this tradition here. So all the troubles that I've created in my life just because I'm busy here and not checking out other people that are involved here. I'm gathering that others have had experience that's similar here. The best one is a guy I sponsor that at the time had a wife and a small child, and he went down and traded the family car in for a Corvette and brought that home. And his bride's going, "Well, okay, where does the kid go?" And I get into this because he's angry because she made him take it back to the dealer. And of course, the salesman told him, he says, "Well, you must not be a real man if you're..." Oh. Now, he wasn't trying to upset his wife or anything else here, but he just kind of lost his mind and didn't realize that other people were going to be involved in this decision. So he was new sober, and they're fortunately he's married to an extraordinary woman, and so they're very happy many years later here. Tradition 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now, that's a great one, by the way, in our group inventory. We sit down, and that's probably one that we spend as much time looking at as most any of the others. You know, how are we as a group? You know, we're quick to take inventory on a personal level, but let's look at how well we're doing in fulfilling our group purpose in terms of carrying this message. Are we still effective, or are we busy patting ourselves on the back for the stuff we did a year or 2 years ago here? Now, in the relationship form, each individual in the relationship has but one primary purpose, to understand the purpose of the relationship and to act supportively. I can remember not long after the cat arrived, this marvelous lady, Linda, she says to me, she says, "Well, Mike, what do you think the primary purpose of our relationship is?" And I know this is a trick question. I pause. Yeah. And, you know, we've had some fun and a great learning experience sitting at... We came out with the, you know, our initial primary purpose is to, in simple terms, to nourish and support each other's spiritual development and growth. And then we have added more to that, but that gave us a place to start in dialogue, and you can have some beautiful conversations around that. You know, because in my marriage, I was kind of like I was my own little operator, and my wife was her own little operator, and we'd subcontract out stuff around the kid and do various stuff and deal with each other. We didn't start out that way. When that marriage was working well, the sweet part of it that she brought to it, I wasn't smart enough to, but we'd sit on the couch at least once a day, side by side, and hold hands with each other, and we take turns talking to God out loud. You know, and it's awful hard, was it for me anyway, to me to spin it and to deviate it when I'm talking to God and I'm holding her hand. You know, "God, she's an idiot. She don't even," I just couldn't say that, you know. Yeah. I'd find myself saying things like, you know, "God, I'm scared I'm not going to get my own way here. You know, I'm 43 years old and I'm trying to learn how to be a parent, and I'm not very good at it, and I need a lot of help." You know, those are things that wouldn't normally come out of my mouth. Now this is also important in my business life. In simple terms, the primary purpose in my business life is to deliver high quality financial planning services, always putting the client's need first. So every day I show up to go to work, I know what I'm about today. It's not about making, you know, when I do that, I find out that I make the money I need. But when I show up just to get some money, it always seems to end up in trouble. But when I've got a primary purpose and I got God involved in it, then it's a whole different ball game. This is amazing. People that would know me, Gary Brown would tell you, he says, it takes a hell of a good-sized check to get Lorenz to come see you before noon. My normal schedule is that I crack the Wall Street Journal in my first cup of coffee about 9 o'clock in the morning. And I can arrange my life so I can do that and so forth. It's hard for me to get up and do something with a lot of energy for a paycheck, but I'll do almost anything for a mission, you know. I'll get up gladly 6 o'clock in the morning here, and I'll feel fine and enjoy it. The same thing when I'm approaching my business, when I've got my mission there, then I'm able to act differently and do a high-quality job at what I'm doing. And by the way, have fun doing it. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. And the relationship form, those in the relationship ought to never endorse, finance, or lend items of the relationship to others, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. I violated this right almost at the beginning of our marriage. I wrote my mother a check for a couple $1,000s to pay some property taxes that she had due. And I looked at that as part of my amends to my mother and so forth. And it was out of my account. It wasn't out of our account and so forth. When I mentioned it, I didn't hide it, but when I mentioned it casually to my bride that I'd sent that check off, she just went ballistic. That's not true. She didn't go ballistic, but she was quietly angry, and I could see she was upset. It's interesting that my fear will magnify particularly a woman's response. You know, she was just displeased with me, and I've got a mind that says this woman's going to rip my throat out. Part of what I've had to learn, I've spent a life overreacting. But the whole thing was here that again, what's wrong? It came out of my account. It was my money. It was my mom. And da da da. She said, we're married. Even if it is your money, your financial situation affects the family here. Are we going to act like a family? Are we going to act like a relationship here? And so forth. That's the kind of thing that's caused trouble. I've had it in smaller ways by just lending stuff out. That's the big one here. Seven. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And then every relationship ought to be fully self-supporting. And And everybody in the relationships needs to be self-supporting. What's that mean? We didn't take Andrew and put him out in the street and make him get a job, you know, when he was three. But he's a member of our family, a member of our relationship, so it's important for him to feel a part of that, that he gets to contribute to the relationship. That's one of the things we did do right. You know, we found three-year level things for him to do and then four-year level things to do. And it was him making a contribution to the family. And so he was became eager to be able to move up to the next level of responsibility. Now, as it came between my wife and I had to find out that support doesn't always come in dollars and cents terms. I thought because I was writing checks for mortgages and doing stuff like that and making car payments that I was being self-supporting in the relationship. But self-supporting means a lot more than that, because I found out that, you know, at times she didn't feel supported even though the check was written. Was I picking him up after school? What was my contribution around the house? There's a lot of ways that these contributions take place other than money, and me just throwing a check in the hat doesn't cut it. Same way around my home group, putting money in the hat is just a piece of my contribution. Picking up the chairs, you know, chairing meetings, doing all this other kind of stuff, those are all part of my contribution around here. And the failure to recognize that my contributions to every relationship are not always in the form of money. In fact, sometimes the most particularly, I found out, Linda could explain it to you better if she was here, but that the love of my life views my contributions to our relationship, probably the monetary ones, as some of the least important ones in terms of our intimacy and how close that relationship is. So lots of learning there. Any questions or comments at this point? Okay. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should forever remain non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Well, here are those in the relationship should remain forever teachable, always avoiding being the expert. How much trouble I've caused myself by being the expert. I'm an amateur computer guy, and so I went over to Linda's and she reported that she had some problem with her computer, so I had the thing apart on the floor before she could say anything here. You need to do this and I'm going to reformat that and we're going to get rid of this. Now I built the computer, so I knew all of this. But I was being the expert here. I wasn't asking her what she wanted and how she wanted and making her a part of this whole deal. Same way at the office when I was telling you that I brought in those outside vendors here that I hadn't talked to my partner about. Now, those were companies that he was perfectly delighted to do business with, but I hadn't brought him in on the decision. I made myself the expert Mr. Know-it-all here in this deal. So I tore up the principle. If I'd thought about this and how's this going to affect unity, I would have done things differently. Yes?
I wanted to give you a definition of an expert. X is a has-been and spurs
are
grip under pressure.
Very good. Yeah. So. Nine. Yeah.
West alcoholic. You were. The expertise is in my relationship has turned into theft. I steal from my wife her ability to be the expert, her ability to those things that are important to her because I think I know more about it. She can end up without ownership of something that is clearly hers to begin with. This has been a hard lesson for us in our relationship. It's getting better.
Yeah, That's very well said. For the purposes of the recording, he just said that when he violates this tradition, he steals his wife's ability to be the expert or a expert and have her expertise from her. And that's damaging the relationship. Yeah, that's well put. Nine, AA such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Now, nine here, each relationship should be flexible in its organization, but the relationship conscious may assign various responsibilities among the members. You know, just because I cooked the dinner and did the dishes once doesn't mean it's my job forever. All of these things, we need to have flexibility and exercise the group conscience to come up with what parts we're all going to play in this. Likewise, at the office, you know, my partner and I kind of had our business model was arrived at it group conscience. I was more comfortable operating on a fee only basis, and my partner liked the commission side of the business. So, and we had clients that wanted to go either way. So, we created a model in our office where I took the fee business and Dave took the commission business, and we kind of laid out before the client when a new client came in and said, you know, there are a number of ways we need to get compensated for what we do here, and there are a number of ways that can happen. It can happen through commissions or it can happen through fees, and you know, it's up to you to decide what structure and that you'd be most comfortable with. And we found that was going to be a win-win for everybody. But before we did that, we spent a lot of time hammering on each other because we both felt strongly about our positions and the righteousness of it, if you will. And so we ended up deciding that there needed, rather than one of us having to prevail, that what we'd do is we'd create a flexible situation. Turned out to be great for us because there was no reason for somebody who wanted a given structure to have to leave us and go someplace else. And likewise, the clients got to pick the structure they were comfortable with. So it brought my partner and I and the clients brought all of us into unity here and helped make us more successful. Here's the big one. Alcoholic 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, since the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. And those in the relationship should express no opinion on outside issues, avoiding heated controversy. An outside issue is what I think of her mother. An outside issue is, you know, my former wife is no little slouch. She's a director of executive compensation for Walmart's main corporate office. Before that, she worked for Eli Lilly in Indianapolis when we were together, and so she's quite a high-powered lady, but she would come home and she would be relating things that happened at the office, and I assumed if she was talking to me about this that she wanted me to fix this for her, and she wanted me to tell her what to do. Oh, well, you need to fire him, you need to hire her, you need, you know, get a break here, you know. In my personal relationships, in all sorts of levels, a high percentage of the trouble I get into and the conflict I get into is about me opening my mouth about something that doesn't have any relevance to what's going on. I saw this demonstrated, as a matter of fact, a number of years ago when one of our old-timers started expressing at the time of the Clinton impeachment, started expressing a lot of political views, not necessarily in the meeting, but loudly around the meeting. You know, if you were within 10 feet, you could hear some. And a lot of it was just informal jokes and this and that and the other thing. But I had a young guy that I sponsored come to me and he said, you know, I hear some of these old-timers talking like this. Now, am I expected to buy this stuff if I'm going to be here? You know? I need to be conscious of when I'm shooting off my mouth. Is it really relevant and necessary to the discussion we're having or not? And what is the effect of me expressing opinions on this going to have on unity? I would hope pretty much that the people I sponsor wouldn't have any clues to what my politics were, for example. I've got opinions, but they don't belong in relationship with people I sponsor, because it could be a life or death situation for them. And so I need to constantly, when I start shooting from the lip, I always end up kind of shooting myself in the foot. And this is one area just very destructive on unity. And I got a great deal of, as a matter of fact, it was Gary's wife, a really great Al-Anon, that in the middle of my divorce, and I was having a terrible time, Julie took me aside and she says, Mike, she says, a couple things here. She said, number one, she said, you need to really actively start practicing the 10th tradition here. She says, most of what Lori's going to do from now is an outside issue and it's none of your business. Don't worry about it. Whether she keeps the house, sells the house, whether she unloads the stock portfolio or keeps the stock portfolio, whether, you know, any of this stuff. As a result of this, I ended up having that I wasn't expecting from this longtime Al-Anon, she said, and before you make any important decisions, make sure you masturbate first. I don't know which tradition that is, but that does seem to save a lot of bad decisions, though. Okay, little feller, here we go again. Oh. But you know, as the result of this, as a stepfather, I had no legally enforceable parental rights. And the number one thing that, with these principles, she was able to show me what to do is she says, you know, it's, what you've got now is a bad situation, but maybe the best you can do right now is not make it any worse than it already is. And so that was the principle, and by not digging the hole deeper and not making it worse than it already is, got to a point where even though I had no enforceable rights, she was glad to share Andrew with me. We split the way. I had him 3-4 days 1 week, and she'd have him 3 or 4 days the next week, and everybody benefited from that. Once we got past, now we couldn't do that in the midst of the actual divorce proceedings, but what it did is it created a climate for healing that could take place once the legal piece of it was done. And everybody benefited from that situation here. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And in the relationship form, those in the relationship best convey their beliefs and philosophy through attraction rather than promotion. Anonymity is a valuable asset of the relationship. I don't have to be the star of the show. I don't have to be the man of the house, the guy in charge. I can be anonymous. That doesn't mean I disappear in my own house, but that means also I'm not the ruler there. then I'm one of the members of the relationship in there. Now, when Andrew was young, that was, as a senior member, I had more responsibility and different responsibility and so forth, but it wasn't in absolute arbitrary authority. I don't exercise arbitrary authority. I don't, not because I said so. Now we all know there are situations when kids are playing in the street and so forth that you don't have time for a discussion about some of these things. But most of the time, there is. And if there isn't time for discussion, there's certainly time for explanation later on. And so my beliefs, I carried them home. At that time, I expected my wife to have the same political beliefs I did. She didn't. I told her she was wrong. There was, and I proved it to her. How'd that work? Yeah. You know, and I've done the same thing with, in the past with my business partner, with all sorts of people in all sorts of situations. I've had clients just do outright stupid stuff. And I've got to realize that they have the right to be wrong and so forth. And I don't tell them they've done stupid stuff. We can talk about it and so forth. And that tends to improve those relationships over time. And then 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Anonymity, demonstrated by unselfishness and selflessness, is the spiritual foundation of our relationship, ever reminding us to place principles before personality. Now, am I willing to give up my right to get my way in order to have harmony in that relationship? How important is unity to me? Am I willing to not be the big cheese in order to have this work out? And I find out I've got an ego that screams that this is wrong, that I need to, because I'm a fearful guy, I need to get control, I need to get both hands on it. Matter of fact, an old timer once told me when he watched me in one of these fits of mine, he says, Mike, I don't think you've got enough self-will going on here. He says, why don't you get another hand on it, you know? And you're only stirring the pot with one hand right now. And I didn't get it at the time. I got it shortly thereafter, when the pot boiled over all over me. But you know, this stuff isn't rocket science. It's kind of stuff like we said at the beginning. A lot of it we intuitively know in our heart, but see, I don't automatically, unless you give me a structure and a framework, and I'm with some people that regularly talk about this stuff, this is not stuff that I will automatically put into practice in my life. When I'm doing the inventory after I'm in trouble, I can say, oh yeah, I should have done this, I should have done that, I should have done the other thing, I shouldn't have done that. I can see that in the process. This is all about me not creating the harm in the first place. And I get to live in harmony at home, in my relationships outside. You know, I got stuff, it's darn embarrassing. It wasn't, well, it's been a year now, year and a half, that I went into my local, my dry cleaner, and they had messed up my order. Now, they hadn't destroyed my clothes or anything else. They just, they didn't starch my jeans right. You know, they were a little limp. And the regular gal wasn't there. There's this teenager who's working the counter. And the regular gal knows that my jeans are supposed to be stiff like cardboard. That's the note they put on them when they sent them out the plant. And I sat there and I just acted like when it reverted to my old self. I became Drill Sergeant Lorenz and I dressed that teenager down, just went up one side and down the other. I didn't swear or anything else, but I left no stone unturned in explaining to them just how inadequate, incompetent, you know, those were the nice parts of it, just, and I turned around and walked out. Now I'm halfway home and I'm going, oh no, this doesn't feel right. Now I'm telling you, I really don't like having to make amends to teenagers. It's just, yeah. And you know, there was a time that I would rationalize not having to do that. Well, look, they pay them to be a customer service rep. They pay them to, you know, they're paid to sit there and take that stuff. And after all, I didn't actually swear at him or anything. So, but I'm, you know, I've got this 17-year-old kid with tears starting in the corner of his eyes. I don't want to be a bully anymore. That's not who I want to be. And all of a sudden, what all I could see is that kid's face and what I'd done. And so I turned around, went back, and told him that the crazy man was wrong, you know. That, first of all, none of this was that important. And second of all, that he hadn't done anything wrong. He just handed me off the shelf what was there for me. Went through it. I get opportunities all the time, and I'm far, far from perfect. But you know, I'm more likely than not now, when I find myself in the line I don't want to be in or whatever, when I get up to that front of the line, I have the chance to take these principles out and practice them and say, gee, you know, I bet this is difficult running the only cash register that's open in the store today, you know. And everybody's in a hurry, and people want to write checks and get taken care of. And you're probably not getting much of a break here, are you? How long do you have to go on this shift? I hope you don't have to work too much longer. You know, there are ways I can bring something to it here and create a little moment of unity if I'm willing to do that. And so I got to ask myself, anytime I'm a part of this, do I want to add to or just take from this? Do I want to be a person that goes through life sucking the joy out of other people? Or do I want to occasionally be a person who can put a smile on somebody else's face? So that's a little taste of this. Why don't we take a break and for however long you want to, and we'll come back and do a little wrap-up session here on 10, 11, 12. Talking about step 9 that I want to clean up here. Number one is, what do we do about the amend, the deal where others may be affected on an amend? And you remember at the beginning of this whole thing, I told you that I was, I got fired by sponsor number two because I was busy having the affair with the married lady and sponsoring her 16-year-old son and playing euchre with her husband. And so the time came to make amends, and I made amends to her first, and at this time they were divorced. And so I took her to lunch and sat there and do what we do to make amends. And almost as an afterthought, while we were leaving, I said, "Oh, by the way, do you have Bill's current address and telephone? I want to get together with him and make amends to him too." And she just absolutely lost all the color in her face. She said, "Oh, please." She says, "He has no idea. We didn't, that's because of you and me is not why we got divorced. And he has no idea of what went on there. And he and I have children together, and we're going to be seeing each other at weddings and funerals for a long time to come, and I just don't want that between us." So I very nearly put my foot in it with the best intentions in the world, because I just assumed that it would be okay. I was pretty new at this business then, but I really avoided a bad deal there in terms of of doing that. And I'm free there because I'm completely ready. I've told her, and any time I've seen her since, I said, you know, if you ever change your mind about letting me approach Bill, please let me know because I'll do that. And part of that was kind of macho, too, because I wanted to be able to go back to my home group and said that, hey, I went to the gun-toting federal agent and told him that I'd been messing around with his wife. When I first got here, I heard some guy talk. I don't even remember who it was, but he talked about liking to walk out on the lake until he heard the ice start to crack, you know. And then when Andrew was a teenager, he brought home this T-shirt. It's this No Fear T-shirt. It says, "If you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much room." And I said, "Son, that's mine. you got to go get another one." So the body's getting older, but there's still a lot of immaturity here that I have to deal with. Tom?
Yeah, well, being from Roseburg and being as advanced as we are in the program there, we have found it works better if you go to your sponsor and go over the 9-step list first before you make the decision.
Yes. Yes, well, I had gone over this list with my sponsor, but see, I've got very selective hearing, you know, and he gave me the right directions on this, and that's how I is just as kind of an afterthought I threw it in there because I had my plan and my vision here for all of this, and so anyway, God saved me from a bad situation there. Another one is where it can't make the amends. I was when I was in the Army, stateside in a training unit. I was in advanced infantry training at Fort Ord, California, in 1966. And there was a guy in the unit who had, I don't know how to put it other than that, he had kind of an unfortunate physical appearance. He seemed to look a great deal like Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler. And so people nicknamed him Himmler. He didn't fit in. Because he didn't fit in, the harassment started. And I eventually became part of that harassment. Things were done to him, some of them seemingly minor, stuff like taking his gear and messing it up before inspection so he'd be in trouble, throwing his boots in the washing machine to ruin the shine on him. Coming back drunk from the club one night, I was down along the beach there and I found this dead baby shark and I took it and put it in his bunk with him. He woke up screaming. The final straw was that somebody took one of those little tent ropes and made a noose out of it and left it hanging in his face from the top of his bunk, he snapped. He broke. They came and picked him up and took him to the psychiatric unit, and we never saw him again. And I managed to push that far enough in the back of my mind that it would pop up every now and then. I would rationalize and kind of did what I did here. I'd find a way to kind of make a joke about it. It was a little funny. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got sober, and you woke me up. I'm sorry to say not immediately, but as I started to walk this spiritual path, when this came up, I couldn't push it down anymore. I knew that there was something wrong here. And so I wrote about it, they became willing to make amends. I mean, I don't even know the guy's name. We just, there was nothing remembered beyond nicknames, and that was a training unit, and everybody just scattered different directions, so there aren't any old Army buddies in there to go back and contact and so forth. And maybe I will be able to make amends directly to him at some point in time if that's what God's got in mind. What God has allowed to happen so far, one of the things that I've been shown, again, if I'm going to live in God's world, I need to be sensitive to and alert to the opportunities to set right the wrongs. And I was at a retreat some years ago. It wasn't an AA retreat. It was just a gathering of men, not necessarily alcoholics. But at this men's gathering, this men's retreat, it came about the man who facilitated the retreat was talking about people that had been shamed and traumatized in their lives. And one of the guys in the audience was a guy that was obviously physically impaired, and he got up and he told about being a freshman in high school and being out at the pool in the summer, and the gals were there, and also the varsity guys that were on the football team showed up. And these guys, I guess to show off for the women, decided it might be fun to play a little water volleyball, and they used him for the ball. They started throwing him back and forth. And this went on to the extent that he sustained permanent and internal injuries and physical damage from it. And so when he told his story, the man that was facilitating that retreat said, well, you know, if the men who did this to you were in front of you right now, what would you want to know from them? And he said, well, I guess what I'd want to know is, why me? You didn't even know me. I'd done nothing to you. Why me? And I found myself on my feet at his side, and you know, and I don't remember exactly what I said, but I said, you know, that I wasn't part of this deal with you, but I've been part of something like it. And what I can tell you is that it had nothing to do with you. I took part in this stuff because I was scared to death. I was part of harassing and damaging somebody because I was so frightened that if I didn't join the pack that they would turn on me, and I knew I couldn't take it. And so I did this out of a complete lack of character and fear. We had a moment together, and I experienced some forgiveness, and I think he experienced some healing. So that's what's been able to happen up to this point. And so even though I may never be able to make direct amends to the man I harmed in the service, if I'm sensitive to it, it's my experience that God will create opportunities for me if I'm paying attention to him and I have a sincere desire to straighten up my past, that God will show me a way to do that. There's another one that I'm really conscious of because it was only a couple of years ago that I even remembered it, became aware of it. No, I remembered it, that I became aware of the harm that I did. I'd been out doing this stuff, and I'm sitting around with a bunch of guys, and we're telling stories about when we were young and crazy. And at that time, I was part of a corporate training program and for a company in Louisville, Kentucky. And we had a couple of corporate apartments in this high-rise deal, and we were on the sixth floor. And the guy that was in the apartment with me was a guy I nicknamed Richard Reefer because he was my antithesis. He was a dope-smoking, guitar-playing flower child. And I was the Vietnam vet. And he was a fairly small guy. And he just irritated me. And I came home from drinking one night. I came back to that apartment loaded, and he was sitting out in the balcony there strumming his guitar and smoking. And without saying a word, I just walked across the apartment, put my shoulder into him, and knocked him off that balcony, and then grabbed his legs as he went over. And he hung him upside down from six floors up over a concrete pool apron. And I was telling this and laughing about it. You know, it was just ha, ha, ha. And all of a sudden, I'm sure it had happened before and I hadn't noticed it, but all of a sudden saw the look in somebody's eyes while I was telling this story. They weren't laughing. And so it became clear to me, obviously, that I'd done some harm here. And matter of fact, that guy said, well, what happened to him? He said, oh, I pulled him back in. He was okay. Oh, really? Well, you know, he resigned and left the training program the next day. So I got to see once again that I'd been the bully. See, one of the things I try to do is I take some of my bad behavior and try and pass it off as cute. Guys will be guys kind of stuff. It isn't cute at all if you're on the other end of this stuff. And so since that time, I've been looking for him, and I may have a line on being able to get a hold of him. That's been better than 30 years ago that happened. But so there are some situations, some things. Don said, you know, some things you've done, Mike, you're just going to have to live with. But I can live with it with God's forgiveness once I'm willing and become entirely ready to have God create the change in me. Because, see, if I thought that I was a man that would do that again, if I might do that again to somebody else, I don't know that I could live with that. But I can live with it, and I can tell you about it today because God has changed me into a man that wouldn't be able to do that today. So that's my cleaning up the ninth step here. And we come, so our book says this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. I vigorously commenced this way of living as I cleaned up the past. Until I was taken into this stuff, I had the mistaken view of the 10th step as some kind of an end-of-the-day inventory deal. And they said, no, we do a little end-of-the-day inventory, but we do that in the 11th step, not the 10th step, Mike. The 10th step is all about immediacy. It's about living in the present, the right here, the right now. And it became plain to me when they took me into the instructions here, and they're very clear. It says, and there's also a promise here. It says, we've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This isn't an overnight matter. It should continue for my lifetime. And they give me the simple instructions here. I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Four things as I go through my day. When these crop up, not if, but when, I ask God at once to remove them. I misunderstood that direction too. I thought I asked and God took them away at once. No, it's my job to ask at once. So it does. The at once they pointed out to me, it doesn't say a damn thing here about waiting till the end of your day. It says at once. I discussed them with someone immediately. That's not the end of the day. It's immediately, right now. And make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone help. We can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Now, one of the marvelous things that I love about my home group is that we've got quite a core group of active 10th step people here. And we all really prize our 10th step buddies. And then when we're in workshop, that circle widens. Because one of the things we do is we actively 10th step with each other. And that active practice of the 10th step turns out to be an excellent way to practice the 12th step. When I've gone out and done, and Gary incidentally introduced this to me. Gary, at the time, he was a new guy. I was a new guy. He was about 27 years sober at the time. He said, "Mike, I did this deal at work this morning. This couple, he was working for a stereo store. He said this couple had come in over the weekend." While another guy was working, and he spent a lot of time working with them on expensive home theater system, and they came back this morning and decided to make the purchase, and I wrote this up as if it was completely my sale. I left cut the other guy out of it entirely. This is. When this is found out, this is going to create disunity among the other people that work there. They're not going to like this deal, and it's going to create distrust and so forth. So, as I see it, I'm going to go clean this up with my boss, and then I'm going to clean it up with the other salesman involved, and I'm going to see to it that he gets 100% of the credit here, and so forth. And he said, we're meeting for dinner before home group tonight. He says, "Why don't we go a little early and maybe we can swing by the Progress House and find a new guy we can talk to." So what he did here is he did a very important thing. He demonstrated to me how a man 27 years sober will still make mistakes. So now I've got some slack. I can expect that I'm going to make mistakes because this guy that's way out in front of me has just made a mistake. And I see how grown-ups handle mistakes. He's going to go to the boss and he's going to tell the truth, and he's going to go to the other guy and he's going to tell the truth, and he's going to give the guy the whole. And then, so he's 12-stepping me with this, and then we turn our thoughts to somebody we can help. So what happens here is this is another piece of God's recycling deal. Gary started out cheating somebody out of his commission, and what it ends up is, it ends up with a 12-step call. It ends up me being 12-stepped and demonstrated how adults and sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous handle mistakes when we make mistakes, not if we make mistakes. And everything gets cleaned up here. This is a marvelous way of living. And it's, like I said, one of the great benefits here is this is a great 12-step activity. One of the things I do when I sponsor quite a few guys, and not all of them are new, but particularly with the new guys, are going to get 10th step calls from me. And I'm going to call the new guy and let him know and demonstrate for him, hey, here's what I screwed up. Here's what I did wrong. Here's what I'm going to do about that. What do you think about it? You have any suggestions? There's some humility in that. Their sponsor is calling them, asking what their suggestion is, and laying his stuff out. So now they clearly know what's expected from them. And we're closer. We don't have a top-down relationship. We're both alcoholics. And I have some more experience in some areas, but we're both alcoholics. And then we're going to talk about, how we can both maybe help somebody else here. And if we do this, this really creates a virtuous cycle, and find that I think it's one of the things that probably keeps our home group as vital as it really is. It, It keeps the water, fresh water circulating amongst us here. And look at this marvelous set of promises here with this tenth step. It says, at this point we've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. I was crazy back in step two. Now I'm sane. This is a sane way of living. I'm not going to live perfectly. I'm going to make mistakes. But in a sane man, I'm going to admit my mistakes and clean them up and help others and move on. That's a sane way of living. My old insane way of living was to deny it, try to hide it, sweeping it under the rug, and blow you off. You know. Now I'm living on a sane basis here. I'll seldom be interested in liquor. Doesn't say never. I still notice that Crown Royal billboard every now and then along Keystone Avenue. If I'm tempted, I recoil from it as if from a hot flame. I react sanely and normally. And I find out this has happened automatically. I will see how that my new attitude toward liquor has been given me without any thought or effort on my part. Now, I complained about this. I thought, you know, I think I've done plenty of work up to now. I wouldn't call it without effort, you know. And they said, well, yeah, you've made efforts up to now, but your automatic response is without effort on your part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I haven't even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. The problem has been removed. It doesn't exist for me. I'm neither cocky nor am I afraid. That's my experience, and that's how I'm going to react so long as I keep in fit spiritual condition. And this next line is something that's very important to me. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. And I don't know about you, but one of the confusions I had in life is I thought spirituality was about feelings. You know. And it's really important for me. I've got this like triple red underlined in here. It says spiritual action. Spiritual is as spiritual does. It's not about how I'm feeling. It's about how I'm acting. Am I taking spiritual action here? What I really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. So how am I going to maintain my spiritual condition? Well, the tenth step here is we talked about, it's an excellent way to do that. We'll move into talking about step 11 here, seeking through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Harrowy, do we have room for that meditation? Okay. Perhaps at the end. Okay. Meditation is just kind of the bedrock of my happiness today. It's the way that I can, primary vehicle I'm given to be in developing that relationship with the God of my understanding. In developing that relationship with the God of my understanding is, if I want to have a relationship with any one of you, the first thing I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to provide you with time. If there's time, no time, there's no relationship. Now, sometimes we may have more time than others, but I've got to provide time. Isn't it interesting, though? You know, I'll tell you, there's one to watch here. I can tell you that my relationship with God is the most important factor in my life, and then I can watch, well, how much time am I given it as opposed to watching the Colts, you know? You know, I got to watch where my feet are going. If I'm saying this is important, I got to watch what kind of what time and attention I'm giving to it. The next thing is I've got to provide access. If you and I are going to have a relationship, you got to have my phone numbers, my email, you know, where I go to meetings and everything else. You got to have access to me and me to you. Same thing with God. I've got to provide access there. And then again, if we're going to have a relationship, it has to be a two-way dialogue. If I do all the talking, it's going to be a one-side. I can't possibly benefit from the relationship. One of the images I got was that, say, if I was a student of physics, and I had an opportunity to have Albert Einstein be my physics professor, and you know, wow, what a deal! I'm in Einstein's class, and it's a small class too. And I go into class with Albert, and I said, Albert, I read the book last night, and this, and this, and this, and this, and I think this, and by the way, you know, wow, this is really great, and this is good stuff, and, whew, I guess class is over. I'll see you later, Albert. You know, I have been in Albert Einstein's physics class, but have I learned anything from Albert? Hell, I might have been in Elmer Fudd's physics class, you know? Same thing with me and God. If I'm doing all the talking, how do I have access to the power, the wisdom, the strength, and everything of that higher power if I'm not listening? And I find out I've got to learn how to be a listener. I don't listen very well. I've got a mind that shuts down. I don't know, maybe I'm not the only one, but if I'm in a discussion meeting, there's only part of me listening to the discussion. It's a bigger part today, but there's always some piece of me that's trying to figure out what I'm going to say when it's my turn. And there's another piece of me that's judging everybody that's talking. You know, that guy's on the money, that guy's crazy, she's, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I need to learn how to listen. And so meditation is my vehicle, one of my vehicles for learning how to do that. God's marvelous. God gave me a free sample early on here. I was probably 60 days sober and just crazier than a tick. And I heard people talk. There was an old timer that came around at that time and at one of the meetings I was at, and he talked about his life changed when he became a devout 11th stepper. And I didn't have any idea what that meant, but I didn't know how to find the 11th step in the big book then, but I went home and I got a 12 and 12 down, and I found the 11th step in there, and I read what it said in the 11th step and the 12 and 12, and I read that St. Francis prayer in there, and I'm sitting in this big overstuffed chair, and I went someplace. I don't know where I went, but I went someplace. And after a while, I came back and, you know, well, this is interesting. Well, 3 days later, you need to know that I was a three-day-a-pack smoker at that time. 3 days later, I realized that I had a pack of cigarettes in my pocket, but I hadn't smoked one in 3 days. Now, those of you that smoke or have smoked, you realize that we reach for that thing automatically. It just happens automatically. Rarely made a conscious decision to have a cigarette. But somehow, even though I'm a three-day-a-pack smoker, didn't have any desire to quit then at all, I just realized that somehow something had happened to me that for 3 days I wasn't a man who needed a cigarette, didn't experience any withdrawal, didn't even miss it, didn't realize it. I was around other people. The minute I realized I hadn't smoked for 3 days, I grabbed my cigarettes and fired one up. You know. But what happened is I got a little glimpse, a little taste that there must be some real power available here to me. And of course, I'm an alcoholic, so I ran right back to that same chair, and I think I don't know if I put on the same shirt, but I you know, tried to get in the same position, everything else, and do the same deal all over again, and nothing happened. You know. And that's always kind of been the way with me, by the way. See, God will do something miraculous for me but he'll do us, always do it in such a way that I can't go reproduce it on my own. That way he keeps it clear to me that it's his power, not my power. Because the first thing I'd say, well, you know, I got the 12 and 12, I got the magic chair, and we'll go on the road now. You know, I may not even need meetings from here on out. You know, I'll go tell them how it's done. There are a lot of fine techniques and approaches to meditation, and I've tried a number of them, and I enjoyed a number of different ones. One of the most consistently good ones for me is involves simply following my breath in and out. But it seems to me from time to time that I'll hit a dead end with whatever I'm using, and I have to get back to first principles. And when I do that, where I always come home to is the basics that are laid out in our textbook. They always are a place that work for me when I return. And says here, step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. I shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than I are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. And then they had a mistake here. It says, when we retire at night. And I knew that was a mistake because it had to be when upon awakening. And so I actually did my own little 11-step guide, and I put things back in their proper order. And till I found out that, you know, the kind of meditation I'm going to have tomorrow morning will be determined by the way I end my day tonight. Not only will I have a more restful day, but I'll have my mind clear to that clutter so I'm really in a place to listen and benefit from the meditation when I wake tomorrow. So, if I want to be successful in the morning, the way I end my day tonight is going to be the way I do it. And this is what I had confused with the 10th step. When I retire at night, I constructively review my day. That constructively is very important. You know, not, oh, you screwed up here. Oh, you blew it there. Oh, you just don't get it. No, that's not constructive. There's no benefit to that kind of a review. I just need to make a factual assessment of how I lived my life today. And they tell me how to do this. Was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Yes or no? Do I owe an apology? Have I kept something to myself that I should discuss with another person at once? Was I kind and loving toward all? I've never been able to say yes to that. Someday, before I leave the earth, I want to. And it was pointed out to me there's a difference between kindness and loving. What could I have done better? Was I thinking of myself most of the time? Of course, you know. I had one of my guys that I sponsor called me the other day, and he says, oh, Mike, I thought I'd give you a call. I was just thinking of you. And I said, so was I. You know, it was. Or was I thinking of what I could do for others, of what I could pack into the stream of life? And then they give me, again, a very important thing. I must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection for a very practical reason. That's going to diminish my usefulness to others. You know, this is this atonement by whipping myself is not only doesn't feel good, it's not effective. It's not useful to anybody. So after I make my review, I ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. You know, this is not a big deal. If you're like me and sometimes have trouble getting this done, one of the suggestions that was made to me is that I sometimes do this end of the day review like at the end of my work day rather than the last thing before I go to bed at night. Sometimes if I've been out at a meeting or out on a date with Linda or something, I come home at night, I'm probably not inclined, I'm trying to blow.